This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good evening, everybody. It's great to see you all here tonight. And for those of you that don't know me, my name's Matt Trinker. I'm the director of the National Museum of Australia. And I'd like to start, as we always do here at the museum, by acknowledging that we meet on the land of the Ngunnawal Ngambri peoples, the traditional custodians of this place. And I'd also like to pay respects to their elders, both past and present. And I extend this respect, this welcome, this acknowledgement to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who are here this evening. Thanks for dragging yourselves away from the Olympics coverage and coming to hear this important and timely debate about the role of sport in Australian culture and identity. It's very timely, isn't it, really? And this panel is part of the National Museum's headline Defining Moments in Australian History project, which aims to stimulate discussion about events that have had or are having a profound significance on Australians. And in consultation with a panel of eminent historians, the museum developed an initial list of 100 defining moments. And then we then asked the public to nominate their own moments, what they thought was important, and ever since we did so, the suggestions have been pouring in, which is good because that was the intention. At last count, we're up to about another 250 extra public nominations. Now, unsurprisingly, for a country that's pretty, do we say, obsessed with sport, in a good way, sporting moments feature on the defining moments list. So on our list, there were things like the first organised game of Australian rules football, in 1858, the first Melbourne Cup horse race in 61, that's 1861. Famously, the Aboriginal cricket team touring England in 1868. Clearly, a lot of things happened around the 1860s in Australia. And then the Ashes bodyline series in the 30s. And of course, even the fact that television was introduced in Australia for the first Olympic Games ever held in this country. And the public's added a great many other moments as well, and they include things like, perhaps infamously, Australia beating New Zealand with a controversial underarm bowl in the final of the World Series Cup at the MCG. I don't know if we've ever gotten over that, quite frankly. It was in 1981, can you believe that? Australia 2 winning the America's Cup yacht race. I remember watching that and cheering the yacht across the line on that last race. And I think it's impossible to forget Cathy Freeman using both flags in her victory laps at the Commonwealth Games in the 1990s, but then, of course, winning the 400 metres in Sydney and bringing a tear to everybody's eye in this country. It's fair to say that Australians are enthralled by sport. Sport helps shape us as a society and often provides a stage on which broader social issues are played out. And tonight, our esteemed panel will explore the role sport plays in Australian life and what role it should play. And we'll hear from athletes on the front line about how it feels to be in the spotlight. I'd like to welcome our panellists, Olympic swimmer Christian Sprenger, former Matilda soccer player Sally Shippard, author and AFL commentator John Harms, Australian Rugby League Commission member Dr. Chris Sara, Wallaroo rugby player Louise Burrows, and of course, our favourite son at the ABC. ABC Radio National host Paul Barclay returns to host tonight's discussion. I'd also like to thank some organisations that have partnered with us in this event and without whom their support for this event it would not have been possible to bring these people together and to have you here for this discussion. In particular, the Australian Institute of Sport, the Australian Sports Commission, Griffith Review, the edition of Griffith Review, Our Sporting Life, will actually be on sale after the discussion, and of course, ABC RN. This discussion is being recorded for broadcast on ABC RN's Big Ideas program next week, and time permitting, Paul will actually take some audience questions at the end of the discussion, so keep an eye out for the staff who will have microphones at the ready. Now, just before we start, can I remind you to switch your phones either to silent or turn them off completely, and I'll hand over to Paul to introduce our panel in detail and to kick off proceedings. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Matt. And yes, thanks to all of you for coming along tonight when there's so much sport on offer on the TV set. very deep level of sacrifice you've shown coming along tonight. It's terrific to be here at the National Museum, always a delight. Love coming here. We've got a collaboration going with the National Museum on a number of fronts, but in particular in relation to their Defining Moments in Australian History series, and we'll be doing another one of these events next month on immigration. Stand by for more about that. As Matt said, I'm from Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. We're recording this for my program. It'll go to air on Monday night. So tell all of your friends who are foolish enough not to be here tonight that actually they can hear it on RN at 8 on Monday or podcast through our website. As Matt said, we are a sports-obsessed lot, Australians. Australian identity and myth-making frequently finds expression on the sporting field. Fair play, punching above our weight, having a go, triumph in the face of adversity, dignity in the face of defeat, sport as a social leveller. We like to see these as things that encapsulate who we are on and off the sporting arena. And millions of us hold our breath when Australians compete, especially when a well-fancied Australian team or individual competes. We are so invested psychologically and financially in sporting success that there are almost Royal Commission type calls for inquiries when we don't get the results that we anticipated, as we've seen in Rio, the wrath that's descended upon the poor swimming team who haven't brought home enough gold for the liking of the Australian media. We're going to be talking about sport and identity and what sport means tonight. Let me introduce our guests in a little bit more detail than Matt did. We have on my immediate left, Sally Shepherd, retired international soccer midfielder and one of the most recognisable faces in Australian women's soccer. At 16, Sally made her international and Olympic debut. Her career with the Matildas included playing at the 2007 and 2011 FIFA World Cups. And Sally's worked as a feature writer for Football Federation Australia and as a commentator for Fox Sport and the ABC. Next to Sally, we have John Harms, writer, historian, publisher and broadcaster. His 2016 publications alone include the books Life as I Know It with jockey Michelle Payne and Play On, the re-release of his omnibus of books on cricket, horse racing and football. He is founder and editor of the sports writing website The Footy Almanac, and of course John appears regularly on ABC TV's Offsiders. Next to John is Louise Burrows, veteran Australian Rugby Union Wallaroo. A physical education teacher by training, Louise has played for the Canberra Royals Rugby Union Club since she was 17, made her international debut with the Wallaroos in 2001. She's a hooker, and she lined up for her third... Actually, that sounds rather terrible, doesn't it?
I know
people
say
that?
She's
good
at it.
Anyway, she lined up for her third Women's Rugby World Cup back in 2014, and she's still going. Well done, Louise.
Thank you.
Next to Louise, we have Christian Springer, who is an Olympic silver medalist, and if I can find my notes, I can give you a little bit more information on Christian. Former world champion breaststroker, world record holder, silver medalist in the Olympics. He won his world championship gold medal in 2013, his silver in the 100 metres breaststroke at the 2012 London Olympics. And he's just recently retired from competitive swimming due to the effects of a shoulder injury. I'm not surprised at all that the shoulders are a bit sore, Christian, after 20 plus years of swimming. And then at the end of our panel, Dr. Chris Sara. Chris has a Master's of Education, a PhD in psychology, and was the first Aboriginal principal of Cherbourg State School. He's a member of the Australian Rugby League Commission and a Rugby League Tragic, and he's also founder of the Stronger, Smarter Institute. Please make our terrific panel welcome. So, John, I'll come to you first of all.
Right.
We have prime ministers who are obsessed with sport. Australians of the year frequently win the are frequently sporting figures. We have a horse race that stops a nation. Where do you think Australia's deep affinity with sport sprang from?
Well, I think
It's something that is not unique to Australia. It's something that human beings have done across time. And it's quite simply, you're born, you die, hopefully you get 3 score year and 10, maybe a little bit more. It's a long time. It's easy to get bored. Sport is something to do. It is quite simply something to do. Whether it's chasing a ball or fighting someone else for a ball or running as fast as you can or leaping or whatever it is. And then what happens when you start doing those sorts of things? They take on ritual meaning. So your community might start to get involved in it. And then if you are from a generation further down the track, you're born into this and you start to see, well, hey, this is what my community does. What's in it? Why is playing soccer so fascinating? What is it about swimming that we love? What is it about rugby league? So if you look at sport in this continent before white settlement, you look at the hundreds, and Ken Edwards' book discloses so many games that indigenous communities had, and equally in other parts of the world that was happening. So when white settlement occurred, the British brought their games to this continent. So then we start to see the fact that these become organised, not just as games, but as sports. So you get the rise of clubs, you get the rise of leagues, and suddenly you've got this institution of sport that people are so interested in and find, importantly in my view, so much meaning in.
Sport is a genuine part of the community. It genuinely rises up from the grassroots of our community.
Well, I think if you look at... Take the example, I've just been at Kapunda for their 150th, which is north of Adelaide, near the Barossa Valley. It's the 150th anniversary of their footy club. Now, that just started as some guys from the mine, copper mine there, playing footy. Something to do. It was a very male community. But then they started to play for Kapunda. And eventually they played against Tanunda and against Gawler. And so it became something that was important to the community of Kapunda to measure yourself against someone else. But, you know, competition is very much part of sport, and there's something about giving of yourself to a common cause.
There's that, but then there's the meaning that sport takes on in a country like Australia, which is arguably greater than other countries. How do we explain that?
Okay, so you then get the next level is to say, right, I'm good enough to play for Kapunda, now I'll play for the Barossa Valley, now I'll play for South Australia, or I'll go down and play in Adelaide at Norwood or somewhere, and now I'll play for South Australia. So there's that sense of representation, and that sense of, well, eventually, say with the case of cricket, you play for Australia. And so then we project, we say, well, how do we measure up against the British, or against the English? Well, we beat them in the first Ashes test in 1877 by 45 runs at the MCG. You know, so you get this sense that it takes on meanings beyond just the simple sporting meanings, because there you put it in a colonial context, mother country, colony, and you've got a whole different sense of meanings, which aren't just about hitting a cricket ball. Mm. They're actually political, social, cultural.
And something like that, an early win against the colonial masters, must, you'd think, be the roots of sport meaning something more than just the competition, just the game.
Well, you could take any incident and apply a particular lens to it. So you could apply the lens of nationalist understandings to it. You could look at rowers, or you could look at footballers. You could say, well, Australian football is, look what we call it, Australian football. Mm. So how does that contribute to a sense of identity? How is that complicated by the fact that the north of the Barassi line, it's a whole different set of understandings?
Yeah.
So a point I would like to make is that sport's not a simple thing to understand and analyse. It's a very complicated thing.
Yeah.
Hence, it's good to spend time talking about it.
It is indeed. We have three elite sports people on the panel, so it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to them and how each of you got involved in sport. Christian, were you a sports mad kid at school, competing in a variety of sports and following a variety of sports?
I did. I think like any I guess kid growing up, I tried pretty much anything. And I tried cricket. I was no good. Tried rugby league. I was even worse. And I was actually not too bad at soccer, I guess, you know. So that was good. But ultimately for me, swimming was something that purely I got into because my siblings swum. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the only reason why I started that sport. It's because my family was doing it. But for me, it was never about focusing all my energy on that. I love the team sports. I love the idea of being involved with the soccer team and winning with them. But I also like the idea of training individually and performing individually as well. So, you know, I was emotionally invested at a young age in sport, because when our school had a victory, it felt like a victory to me as well, you know, regardless of what sport it was. And that's where, I guess, my love of sport all started, because it didn't matter what team it was. If they had a win on the weekend, we'd all talk about it the Monday after. So it was something that the school got a lot out of, and I got a lot out of that. So that was how I perceived it, was way to be a supporter and also an athlete was to be involved with sport. No matter what happened, you know, we took everything, the highs and the lows, and that's what really, I guess, attracts us to it, because it's
sport,
always different.
Was it everything for you at school?
It was a large percentage. I guess I was more of the athlete kind of school student. I wasn't in the libraries during lunchtime. I was probably more active playing handball, you know, as you do. So that's where you'd probably find me. So I guess, yes, in that sense, I was very much in line with activity, yes.
We should say, you started swimming when you were 7. You won a silver medal when you were 27. 20 years of swimming that goes to getting that almost ultimate accolade. And I should say in parenthesis that Christian really should have won the gold medal in that event, because the person who beat you used an illegal kick to do so, I'm told. The illegal dolphin kick.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's a sore point for you.
No, not at all. So yeah, it did effectively take 20 years if you look like that. And to that moment, you know, swimming in that final, you know, he was the favourite in lane 4. He was always probably going to win. I was just happy to be in the final, to be honest. If I'm going to be brutal, I didn't think I was going to get a medal. Executed the race how I wanted to do it. And we did later find out that he had added, you're allowed one fly kick with breaststroke off the pullout, and he did 3. And the reason he wasn't caught is because the officials couldn't see through the whitewash, and ultimately, you know, they didn't see the disqualification. It wasn't until, I think, that night the video footage started coming out on YouTube and everyone could see it and started really getting hit for it. with swimming, there's no video footage allowed to make a dispute or anything, so they don't accept any video footage underwater. So that was always going to stick, and once it started to get a bit heavy, the media came back to me a couple of days, and it started to become a bit of a story of the Olympics, you know, how I was robbed. But ultimately, I said from the day one to, I think I was asked about 2 years ago as well, it took a while to blow over, and they said, you know, you should get the gold, why, you should be so furious, you know, this is so, you've just been robbed of this medal. And I said, look, ultimately, That butterfly kick might have been worth maybe 0.1 of a second.
Yeah.
He beat me by 0.4.
Okay.
He was the better athlete on the night. And I think people gauge that and they sort of say, oh, you know, so much respect for that guy for saying, you know, that he would have lost anyway. Like, oh my God, Christian, you know, that's really, really good way of looking at it. But the reality was, like, I looked at the facts. I know that that guy was better than me on the night.
And a silver medal is a pretty bloody fantastic
Absolutely
thing.
Absolutely nothing to shy away from. So.
Totally awesome. Louise and Sally, you both grew up in country towns. Sally, in your case, Wagga, a pretty big country town, and Holbrook, Louise, which I think you told me that you grew up in Holbrook, and I had to go and Google it, actually. But do you think that growing up in a country town does make you more sporty? Is that, Wagga, for God's sake, you know, so many sporting greats have come through Wagga, Sally.
Yeah, I mean, hands down, playing sport in Wagga is something that all kids do. And from about the age of 5, I'm sure that my brothers played a massive influence in terms of the decisions that I made around what sports that I played. But, I mean, it's a huge part of your identity as a kid growing up in a country town. And as Christian has alluded to, it's what your school does. It's a community. You're already a part of this thing when you're still figuring out, you know, who you are, and sport is a huge part of that experience. And for me, I mean, my brothers all played, you know, sports, or out in the backyard, and when we weren't at school, obviously out on the during lunch times and whatnot. So it was just a part of the fabric. And I think that completely advantageous growing up in a country town in terms of, you know, how I value sport and how it sort of, you know, driven me through life.
And the same, Louise, for you, that, you know, you were involved in sport from a young age?
Yeah, you know, I had access to a number of different sports. I did equestrian as well, and living in the country, you know, the horses were pretty much in your backyard where you were able to go for a ride before or after school, and You know, I actually used to want to go to the Olympics for equestrian. Turns out I'm a rugby union player. But, you know, I always looked up to different role models, and Andrew Hoy was from Colcan, and he, you know, I think 5 Olympic Games. Mm. And, you know, I used to look up to him as a role model and base my riding around him. And so I think for me, though, I did all sports, you know, I played basketball in my mum's team with my sisters. We were in the B grade because there was no girls competition because it was a country town. And, you know, so we had access to that perhaps, you know, in the city we may not have.
Yeah.
Being able to afford to participate in sport. And for me, I think I've loved sport, and at school, you know, we would always enter a soccer team or a softball team in a carnival. Mm. And I think I was always the first one to put my hand up.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm coming. I'll be part of that team. I don't know how to play, but I'm coming to play.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think having access to sport at school really helped for me to have an opportunity to play a range of sports, and actually probably those sports, although I didn't start playing rugby till I was 16, helped to develop a range of skills physically, and also, you know, working within a team and perhaps not being very good because you were playing sports that you didn't traditionally sort of play as your sport. So coming into rugby and really having no idea what I was doing, you know, it was a steep learning curve, but I think we were used to that at school.
Yeah.
I think a key thing too is we haven't had an elitist culture. Sport is not elite sport. Sport is across the whole community. Elite sport is just part of it.
Yep.
If you look at how sport is experienced in this country, really it is hacks like me who continue to do it because we love it, it's fun, it's active, it means something. And we'll keep doing it until it doesn't mean something. So in that sense, if you take the Adelaide Uni Footy Club, they're sixth. They've got sixth. They're called the Chardonnay Socialists. The seventh, if you're in the seventh, they're the scum. And they're happy to be the scum. But they're playing. And I think that's something that has been celebrated in Australian sporting culture, that you know, you can all have a crack.
Chris, you played sport when you were a kid. Was that an important part of growing up?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Bundaberg in the 1970s, youngest of 10 kids. And so there was our house, and there was an empty kind of allotment next door, which we used to call the SCG, Sarah's Cricket Ground. So it was always rugby league and cricket usually, but we'd have a crack at other sports. And we used to have two cows that shared that paddock with us. One was Mavis and the other one was Josephine. All good milkers. But so we come home from school and you'd be down there playing against each other, and sometimes it'd be one-on-one. And there's a fine kind of line between glorious and inglorious when you're racing down the sideline to score and you slip over in cow dung and it's all over. So, but yeah, we grew up playing lots of sport, and so but I never played in the elite space because in my kind of 18, 19, 20, I made the decision to focus on my kind of career as an educator. So yeah, but today I sit on the Rugby League Commission with Wayne Pearce, and our joke is that between us we have 19 tests. I've got 0, but that's okay. But we both started off started our rugby league career playing for the Tigers. He was Balmain Tigers, I was the Wanderers Tigers in Bundaberg.
There's a great tradition, grassroots tradition, isn't there, of sport for Indigenous Australians and in Indigenous communities. I lived in the Northern Territory for a while and was lucky enough to go along to the Uindamu Sports Weekend there and watch the bush football. But of course, up on the top end, there's the Tiwi Islands where sport is played. But equally so in North Queensland. It's
Very you think of like growing up in Bundaberg in the 1970s, right? Joe Bjelke-Petersen was the premier back there, and you know, it was a time when it was okay for people to be racist. But when you're on the sporting field, the playing field is level. And if you want to call somebody a black bung or a black nigger or something like that, you'd want to be good because there's nowhere to hide on the field. And so it was a great leveler. But more than that, it was the one place in Australian society where we as black fellas could be superb, and we were acknowledged and embraced for the excellence that we brought. And so we really came in from the margins on the sporting field, and people celebrated that. And, you know, you hear all sorts of great stories of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians who have a great bond because they played rugby league together.
It's a great paradox, isn't it? It's, as you say, it's an arena of acceptance for Indigenous people. And you think, going right back to the days when racist attitudes were even more common than they are today, people like Lionel Rose and Yvonne Goolagong, and in more recent times, people like Cathy Freeman and Jonathan Thurston and Adam Goods, and we got to see what poor old Adam Goods had to suffer through last year. There is this kind of paradox between the fact that we look up to these people as sporting heroes, yet it doesn't necessarily reflect in their attitudes towards their race.
Yeah, it's why I think I'm biased, of course, but I think rugby league is a great analogy, and last year's grand final in particular is an exceptional analogy for what we could be as Australian society: a level playing field, two Indigenous captains, a whole bunch of Indigenous players who are acknowledged and embraced because they are exceptional, and that's what they bring, and that's celebrated. And really, off the field, we as blackfellas, we know that it's no different off the field, but for some reason on the rugby league field and other sporting fields, if I'm less biased, that is the case. You know, we can be brilliant, and we are.
It was such a powerful symbolic game, wasn't it? The Broncos versus the Cowboys last year's NRL Grand Final. It was a great game of football. But apart
I get emotional
from that,
still thinking about that.
In my Melbourne study on my own, because the kids are all, and I've just got, what are the gods doing to Jonathan Thurston?
Yeah.
You know, what are they? They're toying with this guy. Yeah. Oh, look, now they're going to give him a kick for goal.
Do you know, John, I'm sitting two seats in front of the Prime Minister, and I'm going off my head. And then when we win it, Maurice Payne grabs me and I started to cry. I still get, anyway.
That ball's going to curve through. Oh, no, it's not. It's going to defy physics here. And then, of course, he kicks the goal. But just, I also grew up in Queensland in the 70s, and there were segregations in the community, whether they be on the basis of race or on the basis of socioeconomic status and so on. But in rugby league, that's where I met Indigenous people. Mm. I met Cess Doherty. I met Dickie Rose. I met the Wetherill brothers. You know, and you just meet them as... that we met each other as people, and we ended up playing golf with Cess Stockton.
Because on the field, you get to, you connect with the humanity of each other. Because again, when you're in a team, there's nowhere to hide, and so you've got to be there for each other. Because if you've got some kind of racist attitude or negative sort of sense about your teammate, you can't be as strong as you want to be, and in the end, the scoreboard is going to reflect that you're not as united as you should be. Mm. So you kind of have to be united if you want to enjoy the spoils of the
Sally,
game.
Chris and John are talking there about the emotions of sport that we feel as spectators, essentially watching the teams and the individuals that we're so invested in, and we feel this emotional surge. And I mean, one of the most devastating and excruciating experiences of the Olympics so far for me was watching the Matildas go down. 120 minutes of football, not a goal scored, and the dreaded penalty shootout. And, goal, 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 and finally the Brazilian misses the goal. And the Matilda, who was it?
Katrina Gurry.
Has the kick to win the match. Mm. And I've seen Lionel Messi miss penalties. I've seen Cristiano Ronaldo miss penalties. But when she missed, and then, of course, we ended up losing that, the emotional toll it takes on the spectator is enough. But what about for those on the field? How do emotions play out on the field?
You certainly cannot train for situations such as what the girls were faced with over the weekend. I was exhausted watching that. And I, having retired 2 years ago, I've arrived at this space now where I can watch from the perspective of a fan. And, I can now relate to the way that you would feel in watching a display of, a wonderful sporting match. Everyone's very quick to say, poor Alana Kennedy, that final kicker, in terms of attention, the pressure on her shoulders, but then it is the Katrina Gorry that missed after the world's best player in Marta, missed her penalty.
Exactly.
So it's so touch and go. And I mean, you can talk about this in terms of any pursuit. When you're at that level, It's the experience itself that gives you that. It's no training can get you ready for that type of pressure.
And it's fallibility. It's human fallibility that's part of the great narrative of sport. Like Kate Campbell, and so much has been written about Kate and Bronte Campbell, much of it unfair, I think, Christian, but, you know, the fact that there's this expectation that our sporting heroes in some ways are seen as robots that are just meant to get in the pool and... But the expectation and the pressure must just do your head in.
Sometimes I think the coach thinks we're robots too, to be honest. But but no, it is. I mean, if you look at someone like Kate Campbell, her record, her history will tell you she's a very consistent swimmer. You know, she's able to perform. She's won world championships. She was very ready for this Olympics. She was at the best possible form. I trained with the girls for about 4 or 5 years, so I knew exactly what she was capable of. The one thing that she had never planned for, or anyone can ever plan for, is what it actually feels like to be in an Olympic final as number one. You know, we can go into Olympic finals. Mm-hmm. I went into London as number four in the final. We've seen guys go into number two and get up. It's going in as number one is I've never experienced it. I will never experience it. But it would be
but you did the you hardest did, thing. You did break a world record, didn't you?
Yes.
And then you went into after breaking that world record, the weight of that expectation, didn't you?
So I guess that's a touch of it. So in the semi-final of the World Championships, broke the world record on the 200, and then into the final as number one. Now that whole day, I felt physically ill, sick to the stomach, so nervous that. And this was just the World Championships. I mean, they happen every 2 years. So big deal, but an Olympics is once every 4 years. And there's the eyes on you around the TV, 10 times the pressure, 10 times everything. Everything is multiplied. So for her, you know, she sort of spoke in an interview that her heat felt great, head was in the right space, semi felt great. Again, head still in the right space, very calm, collected. She actually said it happened around about 2 hours after that semi-final swim. And she came to the realization that she was about to swim the Olympic final, something she'd been waiting for about 8 years. And as soon as she thought that, things just started to basically snowball and tumble for her. And as the second your mind starts to even doubt for 1 second that you haven't got the ability or you haven't got the experience, you're done, unfortunately. Yeah. And, you know, for Kate, we've seen this consistent swimmer. She's gone 52 seconds for 100 freestyle up. I haven't seen her gone 53 seconds in years. And all of a sudden she lines up for the final and doesn't get the best start, panics, goes out too hard, swims a 53.
Yep.
You know, so and unfortunately for her, it's over in a minute and that was it, you know. She's got to wait 4 years again. And that's what Olympics is, unfortunately, and that's pressure.
That's pressure. Louise, I want to talk about the fact that both you and Sally compete in sports that have traditionally been seen as male sports, and in your sport, or in a subsection of your sport, the Rugby Sevens pulled off the gold medal. Fantastic effort by the women Rugby Sevens, just totally awesome. Yeah. And obviously the effect of that will be that women's rugby generally, one would expect, will get a lot more attention, hopefully get more people competing in it. But just give us an insight into how hard it is to get noticed as a female athlete playing a sport that's traditionally been seen as a male sport, and perhaps some of the attitudes that you come up against being a female rugby player.
Well, I still have people after playing, you know, how many years? 22 years of playing, I still say to people, I play rugby union, and they say, oh, is it touch? And I'm like, no, I didn't say touch football, I play rugby union, we tackle. So I still, in 2016, get people asking if it's touch rugby. So, yep. And I think there are still people out there that don't believe women should be playing rugby, shouldn't be tackling.
The physicality of the game is confronting for people who think that women shouldn't be playing that type of
game. I know, but I think if they actually watched a game of women's rugby, we're not playing men, we're playing other women.
Yep.
So, or girls are playing other girls. We're not playing against the boys or the men. So it's an even competition, I guess, in the physicality. We're all prepared very similarly for a game. And, you know, I guess the main reason most females play rugby is because we enjoy the physicality. Like, we love that we get to tackle people and it's part of the game to smash somebody as hard as you can. Like, fabulous. You know, you can't walk down the street and tackle somebody. So.
And there, you know, was that great tackle, wasn't there, in the rugby sevens at the Olympics?
I know, I got up early to watch that, and I was watching the game and I was like, oh, this is so challenging to watch. And then Charlotte Kaslik just came across from one side of the field and she made that tackle, a really dominant tackle, and took the US player out.
It was a try-saving tackle.
Up, it was, and she sort of stood up and she flicked her flat. And she kind of looked as if to say, and she kind of, you know, broadened her shoulders and she looked like a strong, athletic, beautiful woman who, for me, I thought, the young girls are going to be watching this going, oh, she's my favourite rugby player because she, you know, ticks all the boxes and, you know, she I love that she's strong and fast and made that tackle but got up as if to say, well, that was
It's fantastic. You need to Google it if you haven't seen it. It's terrific. Things are a bit more advanced for the Matildas. I mean, you've had a profile for quite a bit longer than the female rugby players. But is there still a struggle for recognition in, you know, soccer is the global, is the world game, and the male stars are among the biggest stars in football, you know, in sport in the world. How much are women getting recognised for their participation in the sport, and the Matildas in particular?
Well, we're all maybe privy to the most recent little debate over the contractual stuff for the Matildas with the FFA and
money.
I really try and see it in a positive way, Paul, in that the potential for women's sport in this country is huge, and the growth in the influence that women's sport can have on the likes of young girls and just in the way of like inspiring others is untapped. And I think that there's certainly something more that we can do with women's sport. Specifically with football, I mean, the girls are getting results. We're ranked fifth in the world now, of which is the highest we've ever been ranked. I mean, dating back to 2004 when I made my debut, we hadn't won an international match at a major tournament. And now we're expected to, we have expectations on our shoulders in the way that we're going to perhaps, you know, be meddling.
Yes.
And maybe that's a little.
So there's a new pressure on the Matildas now as a result of that,
Oh, absolutely. And there is progress in terms of our performance. And when we perform, that then means that we can go to the FFA with something quite tangible and say, you need, it's almost like what happens first, like the chicken or the egg. It's you know, we need the funding. Women's football needs the funding in order to get better. But like, what comes first? Because it's a little bit of a tricky battle, because I guess, you know, women's sport has never raised the revenue that men's sport, and that's what the FFA will often come back with us to us with. So it's like, it makes sense, but it's also a pretty exciting time considering the girls are getting the results, and we're always tend to be one step ahead of the men's national team in terms of what we're able to win. I mean, the entire FFA office was pretty, you know, excited about the lead up to the Olympics.
Yeah.
And obviously the girls had that essential focus considering the Olerus hadn't qualified and the young Socceroos.
Yeah, rugby league, Paul, it's been interesting to watch women get on a decent stage these days, and that what Sally's talking about is very real, that notion that the more eyes that get on the game and the more professionally the women are treated, the more skillful they become. And when you watch Australian women playing New Zealand women in rugby league or Queensland versus New South Wales, it's fantastic to watch, and the skill is superb, you know. And as the women understand that, so we as a commission and we as a game are taking it more seriously, more women and more girls are aspiring to play the game because they can see it, you know. And extraordinary feats such as, you know, we talk about Queensland winning 10 out of the last 11 series, but Queensland women have won, I think it was 16 years in a row.
Really?
But they've been playing on some paddock as a curtain raiser to a second tier thing, whereas now they're on the main stage and they'll play the curtain raiser to a test match as they should have been all along, you know. So
you've got John, the AFL have set up a women's competition.
Isn't it interesting, Paul, how the AFL have made us feel as if they invented women's football about 6 months ago?
Yeah.
And what we're going to now see is that these mainstream media outlets are going to go, hang on, there's some probably really great stories here. Let's see how long women's football's been going. Oh, back to the 1920s. Oh, these things. Oh, look at this character. Look at this woman. Look at these people. And so that's another big advantage of what's going to happen, is the sense that there's this history and this tradition that we're now developing, or that the AFL is now developing. So to take credit for the invention of it is ridiculous. But I must say, in terms of the administration of it, to put the season for the 10 weeks before the blokes season is an interesting move, with the grand final being in round one. I think it will give that sort of focus that you're talking about, Chris, and I think you know, that could work really positively.
Yeah. I bet you wish you were still playing for the Matildas, at number five in the world, and all that increased profile. Do you kind of wish you'd still going around?
I mean,
or is the body just...
he's going to make a comeback in rugby.
Yeah. No, I retired due to my knee health, so I absolutely would love to still be playing, but I've also moved on from that and can accept that not all bodies are meant to be elite athletes.
And I'm so excited that I'm still playing.
Yes, exactly. Now you're unbreakable.
With the success of the Sevens, you know, for me, I think I used to wish and hope that women's rugby would be in the spotlight, but I never thought it would be while I was still playing. So I'm really riding the wave. I remember after the girls won the gold medal, I was driving to work, and every now and then I'd sort of stop and listen to a word in a song or something and just start bawling my eyes out, because it wasn't just about them winning gold, but it was what it will do for my sport or for other women's sport, like the league. And
so she's
going
to make the transition to rugby league.
And so, you know, I think it's a wonderful thing. And for us, for the Wallaroos, later this year we're playing a doubleheader at Eden Park with the Wallabies.
That's immense, isn't it?
And that's huge for us.
Yeah.
And I want to be there and experience that. And
I bet.
You know, I think it'll be great, because people will have exposure to it and realise that women can play rugby.
I think a word of caution is worthwhile as well. In this, like, even though the trickle-down theory of sport has some merit, I don't think it's a cure-all. I don't think it automatically happens. I actually like the model, which is a pyramid from the base, where we give so much opportunity to schools and clubs and so on. So we create a love of the game amongst as many as possible who take it up. And out of that, talent is revealed, not by saying, oh, here's an athletic-looking individual. What sport is she suited to? Oh, she could be a gymnast, she could be a rugby player or whatever. So the love of the game emerges, and the representation at the top level is just the natural elevation of the talent.
Yeah.
That model is not the model that we have in place at the moment. We have in Australia a top-down model, and I think one of the antipathies for the Olympic Games at the moment, if you're in pubs, you're hearing people talking about it, is because people feel it's top-heavy. So much funding is going in at the elite level rather than we're making a lot of Lamingtons, we're selling a lot of raffle tickets, you know. We've got kids who love the game.
Yeah. Part of the discussion tonight really is about sport being more than just sport, standing for something more than just competition. And Christian, what of course that means is that athletes and competitors become more than just athletes and competitors. They become role models for the kids who look up to them, increasingly on the TV set. And there's a whole new raft of stars that have been born in Rio, some young swimmers who are going to become household names when they get home, and there's going to be pressure on them. We've seen how difficult that has been for some swimmers. I mean, Grant Hackett, for example, has had his difficulties. Is it fair enough, do you think, that people are seen as role models? And is this too much of a burden for many young athletes to take?
It's a tricky question, I guess. You know, when we talk about role models in young kids and looking up to different sports, I think every sport has, I guess, different ways in how they should be or need to be perceived too, because I think For swimmers, you know, it's a very healthy, clean, streamlined sport. We get very heavily criticised when even the smallest thing happens, or we're caught doing the tiniest of insignificant things. Whereas more of the team sports, maybe treated differently in that idea that it gets sort of spread amongst that team in terms of if something goes wrong, it's sort of diffused a bit easy, where if it's one individual athlete, it reflects on them, but then ultimately the whole sport, all of swimming gets dragged through the mud kind of thing. Mm. Whereas if it happens to a team, I said it is confined. But, you know, coming into this Olympics, we obviously had a lot of kids looking up to your number ones, your Campbells, your Cam McAvoy, yep. Bronte, Mitch Larkin, and yep. Emily Seebohm. And you know, what kids need to see and what younger athletes need to see is that although they didn't get the results they wanted, you know, you watch them on the interview and how they compose themselves. It was actually quite good. You know, inside I know exactly how hard and how they're feeling, and I can tell
it's incredible. I think their performances in the face of those post match interviews is just incredible.
Yeah, I've heard firsthand that after these interviews, things have been very hard for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can tell you definitely firsthand that, you know, they had an obligation. Obviously, you get a camera thrown in your face, and look, it's all part. They know that it's all part of the territory. You do the interviews, and it's all part of the process. But, you know, they give you as much as they can, and they try to uphold the values of a good athlete, and they do that. But you know, they have to vent as well, and whether that's emotionally, whether that's this or that, they do keep that in a good spot. So I think this Olympics was a great eye opener. I think for when things do go wrong. You know, although there's a lot of criticism about the funding and everything with swimming, we can safely say that these athletes have done literally everything they can to be proud Australians, and that's ultimately what we want out of the sport, really.
In terms of pressure, I just as a human being, I was shocked for Anna Mears to apologise to us as a nation. I'm like, what kind of power, like what kind of expectation do we have on these athletes? Yeah. Like these poor, like they've only got a heartbeat at the end of the day. Like we want, I struggle to fathom sometimes how I was an elite athlete because I feel like I've lost my competitiveness a little bit. I'm just like, they're doing extraordinary things. I mean, we're talking milliseconds for these races that they're losing by. And for poor Anna to feel like she has to apologise?
It's an indication of the pressure that they feel, though, isn't it, from the Australian public. And I think also Kate Campbell referred to the fact that the biggest choke in Australian history, I think, was the quote she used to describe her own swim. So they're feeling this pressure, clearly, from the public.
So I'm interested in the origins of that, because I'm not sure it's entirely just public. I think it's more than that. I think it's systemic. I think it's if you're the career of a coach, and if the career of an administration is dependent on the performance of someone they have no control over, then I really want you to win a gold medal, but I'm going to tell you just to do your best. I mean, it's more, I'm not suggesting that's a simplified response. It's a complicated milieu that needs to be unravelled. Because, it's someone getting out and saying, my self-worth is not dependent on my performance in the pool. To analyse that statement is a complicated task. Hang on, you've been a swimmer for 20 years, you really believed in the sport that you're in, and you're disappointed in your result. What is the impact on you? You know, I was with Charlene Rendina on Monday night, and she was very evidently, very clearly someone who believed in giving your best is all you can do.
Yep.
I had no reason to doubt her. You know, she still holds the 800 metre women's track record. But everything she said spoke to that philosophy, everything. Now, she's a mature, contemplative woman now, whereas I feel I'm getting mixed messages from athletes who are younger and trying to understand the
position. Because athletes are intensely competitive people who want to win, clearly. Well, and how do you balance that fierce desire to want to win, I mean, single-minded desire to want to win, with the fact that sometimes you can't
and win? Physically well prepared, but maybe not mentally or emotionally, or they put those pressures onto themselves that really aren't necessary, and they might be thinking they're well prepared, but really there's
all
something.
All I'm saying is I think it's complicated.
Yeah.
I think it's,
With Just on that, I mean, in swimming, we go back to, you know, 2000, we had Thorpe, Hackett, all those guys. We rallied about 10 to or so medals at the Olympics swimming alone. 2004, same sort of thing. Hackett, Thorpe, you know, we had those names still. And now I felt the sense of the swim team, 2008, 2012, it was almost like we were designed or we needed to replicate what that was done because that's what is expected of the public. Mm. And that is where it came to. Now, you've got these young swimmers who are automatically going to Olympics saying, well, we've done this in the past, we have to do this again, or it's trouble. Mm. And that's the sort of, because we've had such success in the past, and we go back to the 4x1 men's in Sydney when they beat the American team, you know, that was game-changing. You know, in 2001, the World Championships, Australia actually beat America on the medal tally. Yeah. Like, that just never happens.
Yeah.
And so we built this profile swimming, which is why swimming is so, so big at the moment. But unfortunately, you know, it's hard to deliver when the world is caught up. The Europeans, everyone is in the same boat now, and it is getting stronger and stronger.
I mean, historically, swimming, though, has been,
you
know, very much a part of our culture. I was thinking about Dawn Fraser's win in three consecutive Olympic Games, gold medals in three games, quite possibly could have made it four, and thought how poor old Dawn would cope under the media pressure of today, given the type of person that she was.
I take comfort in the fact that these are the discussions that were being had in the tavernas of ancient Olympia, 400 BC. I'm not kidding here. I mean, this is what we call the argon of the athlete, the test against themselves and the test against their opponent, from which we get the word agony. Not just a little, No, your whole sense of self is caught up in it.
Yep.
And it's been written about for centuries.
Okay, I'm also interested in how sport can play a role in social change and social issues generally. And Chris, you're best known in Australia, I think, as an Aboriginal educator and somebody who's been lifting the bar of expectations for Aboriginal kids, trying to get them to focus more on reading and on schooling and so on. Can sport play a role in helping to get kids more involved in education and schooling and so on?
Yeah, absolutely. We saw the perfect example of Jonathan Thurston sending a shout out to kids in Aracoon because he knew they were struggling. He said, get yourself to school. So, and these guys take that sense of being role models very seriously. You know, they know that when they say something, people are listening.
Yeah.
It's disappointing, you know, to reach back into our earlier conversation to know that there's so much, particularly in rugby league, there's so much positive stuff happening and young men and young women engaging in community development stuff and giving so much of their time, yet you see one thing that's controversial and that's the stuff that will hit the papers. But there's no doubt that, you know, the big names in our game can influence change in a positive way, whether it's getting kids to school, get them to make healthy choices about what they're eating, to stay off smoking, get plenty of sleep, all of those sorts of things. And it does have an impact.
And Sully, you've spoken out and used your platform as a sports person to speak out about various issues. You've spoken out about eating disorders, for example, and your experience about that. Do you think that does help to promote a conversation in the community about mental health and those type of issues when you come from the sporting arena? And have you consciously used the profile that you've got in that area to do that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, in terms of my own struggles with eating disorder per se, it was more the fact that I just wanted to raise awareness of the issue in society. I didn't want it to be, I have the answers for you.
Sure.
It was more just, this is my story, and I feel like the world's a better place if we share more of our stories. And as a result of being an athlete in my, what I would consider a pretty privileged position in terms of, you know, reaching a good number of kids, I think it's a valuable part of who I am. And I think more recently, since retiring, I've recognised that I can be an advocate for these things, you know, for social issues and causes that are near and dear to me, whether it be LGBT stuff or, you know, marriage equality or mental health in sport. Chatting with young kids about the importance of, I mean, we train our bodies in such a way, but you can't neglect your mind as a result of that. There was a year in throughout my, you know, span of 10 with the national team that I remember. It was this incredible, vivid year where my mind had fused with my body, and I played the best football that I'd ever played But it took me about 8 or 9 years to figure that out.
Mm. Yeah. I think, Sally, it's important that you, when those, I guess all of you would have been confronted by demands to be the voice for this or the voice for that. And I think, you know, I watch guys like Jonathan Thurston, Kathy Freeman, you know, and for us as Blackfellas, we load so much expectation on them, I think, in a way that's unfair. I mean, Kathy runs fast,
yep.
And she's pretty shy, and Jonathan's pretty shy, yep, as well, but he's the best rugby league player in the world. And often that's enough, and where they can lend their voice to things, that's great, but we can't expect them to be everything for the Aboriginal cause.
We project onto them, don't we? I mean, I think with Kathy Freeman in the 2000 Olympic Games, there was a sense that there was more at stake here than winning a race, a 400-metre foot race. There was a sense of somehow Kathy's victory symbolising some unfinished business in our history. Mm-hmm. And that's why we held our breath. I mean, we held our breath because we wanted her to win, but we also held our breath because we knew that win stood for something bigger. I mean, that's part of this discussion tonight, how sport can rightly or wrongly represent bigger kind of aspirations. And yeah. I think that at the moment, one of the challenges we have as a nation, one of the many challenges, is the issue of racism in the community. And John, we saw, you're from Melbourne, you get along to the footy, the AFL footy, mm-hmm, a bit, and that deplorable chapter last year of Adam Goods, whenever he got the footy being booed. It was an unsavoury... unsavoury business, wasn't it?
You know, talk about tears in your eyes when you're in that sort of situation. And I remember going to Geelong to see Geelong playing Sydney, thinking, I just hope I'm a Geelong supporter. What's my community going to do here? How is it going to respond to Adam Goods? And, I think that the level of connection that people had with both sides of the coin on that was really illustrative. Now, I was really interested in how Waleed understood it.
Yeah.
And he said, look, we're happy as a community when certain sections of the community remain silent and do what they're expected to do. The broader community just says, yep, that's terrific. But as soon as someone becomes a bit lippy, well, then they need to be put in their place.
Asserts their culture, as he did with the spear throwing on the footy field.
Now,
yeah.
You know, obviously, I thought it was a fantastic moment. Yeah. But clearly there's a lot who don't. Mm. So how do we then understand our own community in relation to that? I think it's, you can't be definitive on these matters, but the very fact that I felt a lot of us were affected, and I'm not a black fella, deeply, emotionally, spiritually, is indicative of what it actually means.
Well, I was at Victoria Park the day that Nicky Winmar pulled up his shirt and showed the crowd his black skin, and he'd been mercilessly booed by the Collingwood supporters all day, and it was one of the most shameful things I have ever seen, actually. And thankfully, it was a bit of a turning point for the AFL. It was at that point they realised they had a serious problem, although one has to ask how successful they've been at addressing the problem, given Adam Goods.
But the AFL cannot be a social changer. It can have a role in it. And this, I think this is a problem with the AFL, that it actually runs football, okay? And if these things are attendant to it, yes, these guys are in a position with profile and they can have an impact, but they don't necessarily have a responsibility to have that impact. I would like to think they would choose to take that responsibility, in which case it can be a force for great good. I don't know, Chris, what do you think?
I think, John, I might... gently disagree, sure, because I think as a game we do have a responsibility, and I take very seriously, you know, sitting at the commission table, the fact that sport is a good analogy for what society can be. And so if we allow those circumstances to emerge unchecked, then, you know, it's like that saying that the behaviour you walk past is the behaviour you condone. And in our game we would, you know, what should I say, because I don't want to bring on anything, I don't know what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks or whatever, but it's inconceivable that in rugby league that would have happened. I know that we at the commission table, we do take very seriously those circumstances, and there's some point at which we understand we are a game, and that's true.
Yeah.
But some other point, we do influence how young people think, and our guys on the field and our women on the field are role models for other young people who are growing up, becoming a part of the fabric of Australian society, and we take that quite seriously.
I agree, it has to be called out. I have no problem.
I think as a nation we've got to admit that racism exists, you know, and be okay about that. Like there's nothing more sickening than listening to a politician saying, oh no, there's no racism in our society. Well, get over that and let's just accept that it does exist.
Yep.
But when it does emerge, we're prepared to ensure that there are consequences for it, because racism exists in every nation throughout the world, I'm sure.
Yeah. Louise, we love a winner in Australia, but we also love to watch people and how they conduct themselves on the sporting field. And one of my great moments in Australian sport is the John Landy and John Clark 1 mile race in 1956. There's a stumble and one man gets and helps the other man up. And interestingly, it had a contemporary reflection just yesterday in the 5,000 metres women's race heats in Rio, where one woman fell over and another woman stopped and helped her up. And then at the very end of the race, there was this beautiful embrace between the two of them. Does sportsmanship or sportspersonship still matter? Is it, or is it being lost to this winner-takes-all attitude that your sport is about these days?
No, I think, you know, sportsmanship is huge, you know, on and off the field. And for rugby, especially as a very physical contact sport, I think it's really important that whatever does happen on the field, because the aim is to tackle people hard, you know, win a set piece like at scrum time, you know, dominate your opposition prop. And sometimes you may do things that could be frowned upon, but to know that when you walk off the field, and I guess for myself, when I go to a national championships or something and I get to play against my fellow teammates in the Wallaroos, you know, occasionally at the bottom of a ruck or something, we'll say hi or tap each other on the shoulder and get up and run off. Or we might say, great tackle, you know, that hurt. But after the game, we really embrace each other and let each other know that we appreciate that we didn't hold back and that we put everything in.
Same.
Well, I'm not going to use a football reference, but I will use a netball reference. Did anyone watch that epic contest a couple of weeks ago between the Firebirds and the Swifts?
Mm. Yeah.
So we would all be privy to Laura Geitz and Shani Leighton in that they're both goalkeepers and contesting for that number one spot in the Diamonds. Mm. Their embrace at the end of that game, there are images of it, and I'm good mates with both of them, probably more so with Shani, in no offence to Geitzy. But Shani lives in Sydney and we can't hang out and whatnot. But I thought instantly, I'm like, Shani, what is going on in your head? You've just lost. But you're embracing this woman. And Shani, and this is such an indication of the maturity of the player that she is, throughout that match, Geitzy led from the back. Shani was able to conceive throughout that game that essentially the reason why the Firebirds were able to keep it together was because of that girl, because of her direct competitor at the end of that end of that court.
Yeah.
And that was what's going through her head during this embrace. It was gorgeous.
I think a big part of sport is the transcendent. And games like the Thurston game got into the transcendent. Mm. That game got into the where it becomes something more than the mundane routine fixture.
Yeah.
It has meaning because it's a big game. Mm. It has meaning because of the way it's played. It has meaning because the competition is so magnificent. And you just get so taken in by it.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, it can happen in junior football. It can happen in local tennis. There's something that will take you to another place.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, no, and I mean, part of that too is the psychological component of watching people perform under pressure. Watching Phelps and Usain Bolt performing at these Olympic Games has just been utterly awe-inspiring, I think, because of the immense pressure on them. And Bolt especially, that kind of way he's got, that loose way he's got of running, is, I mean, for me that's an aesthetic pleasure, actually, just
watching
him run.
Well, that's another element of it,
isn't it? The beauty of how he runs and the way he conducts himself. Look, we're going to take some questions from the audience, but before I do, and there's So many questions I haven't had time to go through, unfortunately. I did want to, this is part of the Defining Moments series at the National Museum, so we're kind of pinpointing moments in history. So I thought I'd give everybody a chance to pinpoint their one moment in sport. And it's a bit unfair, isn't it, asking them only to pick one. But you have one moment in sport. Chris, what is it?
Oh, I know exactly what it is. I mean, we talked about the grand final won by the Cowboys, we remember, and we talked about Cathy Freeman. But for me, it was... I could go on about this. I get emotional thinking about it. But State of Origin, 2 minutes 35 in, Arthur beats and smashes his teammate Mick Cronin, and everybody knew State of Origin was real. And so, you know, you can imagine that moment where the sperm impregnates the egg. It's like
I try to imagine.
You can see it, right? That is the moment that State of Origin was conceived and became the greatest sporting spectacle on the planet. Forget Ashes, forget Super Bowl, the greatest sporting spectacle on the planet, probably in the whole universe.
That's a beautiful thing, Chris. Christian. Beat that.
Okay, yeah. I don't think I can. I think we should all just, you know, pack up. But no, I think for me, you know, I did speak about obviously the 4x1 men's back in 2000. It was an unbelievable race. But for me, I think in 2004, it's a swimming memory, yep. Obviously. But in 2004 in Sydney, the Olympic trials were on. And probably a few of you might remember Ian Thorpe falls in the 400 metres in the heats, disqualified, out of the race. And this guy's the reigning Olympic champion from 2000. And there's just shock across the nation, effectively. This Ian Thorpe's just fallen in, and no one can believe it can happen. Grant Hackett's on the sideline, just absolutely godsmacked. You know, no one can even believe this has gone on. Anyway, the final goes, and obviously Craig Stephen gets second spot behind Grant. And and then it's put to him that, you know, he steps aside to let Ian Thorpe take that race in Athens. And, you know, I can imagine what Craig would have been thinking at that point. It's the individual swim for him. He's got to give up for Ian Thorpe. And for someone like Thorpe, you know, obviously he wants to be there, but the pressure would have been immense because this kid's taken away the spot and just slotted in Ian Thorpe in the idea that he's just going to go and win. Yeah. But there's so much more to it than that, and you know, leading up to it, it was all about this trade-off, and then even going to the competition, it was the big 400 freestyle. And when Ian Thorpe finished that race, you know, he did win it by, you know, half boy length on Grant, but it was just like an Ian Thorpe that no one had ever seen before. He only turns around, does his double fist, world record, whatever, but he just lost it. And for me, I think that was the moment when I realised, this guy is not just Ian Thorpe, invincible. He is actually human, and he really deserved 100% credit for doing that swim because it would have been one of the hardest swims to do that he's ever done.
Fantastic.
That's great.
Louise.
Well, mine's very recent.
Yeah.
Last Tuesday morning at about 8:30 a.m. the girls winning gold.
Yeah.
You know, all year I've been saying the Australian women's sevens team are going to the Olympics and they're going to win gold. Australia is going to fall in love with these women and they'll become household names.
Yeah.
And maybe at the back of my mind I was thinking, gee, I hope I'm not just saying that. I really hope this does happen. And when I was sitting there watching before kickoff, I was so excited, but I was so nervous as well. Maybe that dream, that hope, that it wasn't going to happen. But then I thought, well, silver's great. You know, I actually did think that. I thought, well, silver's good. They're in that match. And then towards the end, there wasn't much longer to go, and my son said, I'm almost getting emotional thinking about it. He was like, Mum, if they win, can I jump up and down on the couch? And I said, you can do whatever you want. And so then my daughter and my son was... I was on the floor and we were embracing each other and just jumping up and down with excitement. And for me, I just thought, not only is this wonderful for women's rugby, for sevens and 15s, and, you know, for those that have played before us that have left a legacy, you know, these girls are now leaving a legacy for the future players. But I just think for women, you know, any woman watching would see these women as strong and powerful and beautiful. And I think that's a great message within itself, that we don't need to stereotype people in a certain way, that, you know, but to watch them and win gold and play so well, you know, it was
yeah, very special.
So special.
Absolutely, yeah. John?
Mine's more of a broad thing, but yep. I'm going to go with a quick little one as well. I think the rise of clubs in Australia in the late 19th century is just such an elemental part of how we understand sport now, that on the back of this generations of people being involved in clubs and giving of their time to pursue something that they absolutely love, and out of that emerges leagues and so on. So I would say the way we have done that on this landmass is really interesting across all cultures. Quickly, I think one of the greatest post-event sports interviews is Michelle Payne's interview with the jockey Sam Hyland after the race. Mm. If you ever want the expression of a pure sporting philosophy, and then for her to embrace her brother the way that she did, and then to make the statements, I'm getting emotional about it, from the podium. Sensational.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, these are great moments. Sally?
I'm not going to be specific as such, but my favourite athlete, hands down, female athlete with a disability, Louise Sauvage. Mm. And I don't mean with a disability in order to highlight that, but that woman is incredible. Yeah. I was privy in meeting her at 16, and we've developed this lovely friendship over the last decade. And I mean, 9 gold medals at Paralympics, 4 silver, Order of Australia medal, was born with a severe spinal disability, knows no different. From her childhood was no different to any other kid as far as she was concerned. And she is the most inspiring, most decorated athlete in my eyes, but the most humble, the most endearing, and the most precious human being. And she would be hands down my favorite. I mean, the race that she won in 2000 at the demonstration event at the Olympics, the way that she tells the story in the lead up to that is incredible. And in retrospect, that would then be my favorite moment, although as a child I didn't recognize that would be my favorite moment, but as an adult I can absolutely look back on that and own that as being my favorite.
Fantastic. What a great selection. It's so hard to pick just one. Look, boy, I'm going to wrap up with some questions from the audience. We've got about 15 minutes or so for you to fire away at our great panel. So we have I think a microphone attendant who is about to put a microphone in the hand of one of our guests.
What a wonderful discussion it was. But I have a question. I have Danish friends, and they have asked me a question which I don't feel I have answered properly. And the question is, what is Australia's national sport? And not just from a spectator, but also from a participating, from people. So what is our national sport?
I'm lucky.
Well, you know what I'm going to say.
That's
right?
A question, isn't it?
Do you need to ask me?
Our national sport. We know what Chris is going to say.
Greatest game of all.
Very hard.
Is it a competition between rugby league and Aussie rules, John?
I think you need a more universal sport. So
spoken like a truth sporting diplomat.
So probably cricket is more likely to be one. I think we will see the rise of the world game, and that's just going to happen. And I don't make any value judgment on that. If that happens, it happens. They're all great games, you know, and they have meanings for people. So, but I'd go with cricket.
It's interesting. Not in
Queensland.
Like your answer.
It is interesting, and I don't want to seem too biased, although I think you've got me pegged already, but it's why the NRL reached out to embrace touch football as a gateway game into rugby league. So it's pretty broad. But I'll
always think of you know, swimming and surfing really as being kind of very...
Yeah, going to the beach.
Know, very much yeah. Australian yeah. sports, yeah.
Beach cricket, maybe.
Hi, thanks very much for coming down, guys. I've found the conversation very enlightening. Christian, I said I was going to go easy on you, mate, so interpret that how you will. But I'm just curious as to what you and the panel think should be the metric for success, given that a lot of our Olympic sports are very reliant on public funding. Should we still be as focused as we are on achieving gold medals and podium success, or is it enough for us to take a values-based approach? Is it good enough that we're there, as you said before, the swimming team probably gets a gold medal for a class act in the way that they've responded to some of our disappointments? Is that enough in itself?
I guess I'll be starting that one.
It's an excellent question,
it is,
actually.
It's a great question. And it is relevant, obviously, with what's going on. There is always going to be a tension based around that. And I guess typically your average idealistic person would be putting money into something you see a return. You know, we always argue that is the ultimate result. And for us, Olympics, gold medals. You know, that's the easiest formula that we try and put together. The question is obviously, as you put before as well, you know, your challenge with does performance come before funding, and what is the actual metrics, and it is really tough. And for me personally, I think, you know, it is something that I don't think there is a perfect answer. I guess every sport is going to be different, and everyone and every operation is going to have different ways of obviously answering that question. But how we perceive things, and I guess in the media, what was it around about the 40 million for swimming, let's say, was over the last 4 years of funding. There was an amazing article written that I read this morning. There was a Gold Coast physiotherapist. Actually, he had a bit of a document standing up for the swimmers, basically. And it talks about that taxpayers spend around about $40 million a year, for 4 years, and arguably so, we want to see results. But then it goes into saying, of that, we also spend a lot of money in other areas. You know, the athletes, were they worth it? We saw great sportsmanship, all these things. Okay, we didn't get the medals we wanted. But there's around about $8 billion spent in hospital care for other areas, such as, you know, things like obesity. And is spending that measly $40 million helping inspire the next generation to get into sport and to hopefully ultimately get to that place and limit that obesity rate? You know, there's things like that. Can we deflect the situation in that way and think of it as more of as a positive spend? But it is very hard to justify it when the sole purpose of something is to put money in to get gold medals. It's you can't really measure it like that, I don't think.
They really pumped up the expectations, John, didn't they, before these Olympic Games? I mean, the people who run these sports were actually the very people who were predicting Australia was going to finish in the top five on the medal count and X number of medals from the pool and so on. So in fairness, this is not something that the media is beating up. This is a standard that the sports...
Really?
The sports themselves have set... Well, the media is in part beating it up, but the sports themselves did set that standard.
But I think the media embellishes it. I mean, it goes with it. Because you've got to remember that people who love sport are going to be watching TV, reading the paper, listening to the radio. Their eyeballs, which are already fixed. So in terms of marketing, and which we have to bring into this, they're safe. It's new eyeballs that the marketers are looking for. So it's the ones who don't usually turn the swimming on or the rugby league on or whatever that the marketers are trying to get to. So how do you do that? You make it like a school swimming carnival. Rah, 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 Australia. Here's person A, person B. She's going to win. Oh, right, now let's watch. Kate Campbell's going to win. So you've got a narrative which this then... she's won the first one. So all the eyeballs are there. Now, with Steve Renoff, the Courier Mail were brilliant at it. So I wrote a book about Steve, a great rugby league player, as you know, from Mergen. He was manipulated to a degree by News Limited in the sense that he was going to be on the front page as a footballer, but then they worked out, hang on, there's a whole middle-class audience and a whole female audience that can be attracted by turning this guy into a lovable character. So here he is with his wife, Liz, schoolgirl sweetheart, and here they are getting engaged, and here they are getting married, and here they are having their first child. So is it about rugby league, or is it about someone who is in the eyes? So I think the media do embellish it, and I think they do use it for their business of selling papers and selling advertising, and I think that sometimes creates issues.
Well, I certainly think the treatment that the swimming team has had by the media and you know, Kate Campbell especially, has been just incredibly unfair.
But we're also talking with another complicated milieu, and that is the relationship between sponsors, advertisers, media, those who run sport, how government funds it, and how then the athletes are, what's their place in all of this? Did you ever feel, for example, Sally, that you were a sort of pawn of, in a game of big business?
I don't.
I mean, or I potentially could be. I mean, or perhaps the male soccer players.
Yeah, I mean, I don't ever feel like there was that like money up for grabs in order for that pressure to
you
be
wish.
Wrong person.
Yeah, but I know, for example, I mean, I don't know the girls' personal experiences, but I know that in the most recent debate with the FFA and the PFA and the Matildas and the collective bargaining agreement that they wanted to push through with the Socceroos, that the girls were used as pawns in that.
They were.
Absolutely. And I'm not exactly sure of the details there, but my heart went out to the girls because they're, I mean, they play soccer very well. They play football very well, but the rest isn't really up to them. If the PFA, they have their best interest, they presume that the PFA has their best interest. And if they don't, that's who are representing them. It's a tricky little domain. Mm. And it's uncharted territory at the moment in terms of women's football because we've only just started dealing with money.
I'm going to take another question because we are very much almost out of time. So let's squeeze another question in.
My thanks to the panel for an excellent discussion. You've talked about some of the more honourable aspects of the effects of the way that athletes conduct themselves and their impact on the wider community. What about the smashed racket episodes that happen from time to time when things don't go so well? What responsibility do athletes have to the game itself and to the grassroots from whence they came?
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, from an athlete's perspective, I mean, kids that are on the scene from a very young age, their maturity levels, I mean, they're still growing, they're still figuring it out, they're still managing their emotions and becoming, you know, mature adults. And I think as society, we have to accept that that's going to be the case. I think that it's as though human error, for example, in swimming, it's going to be there. I mean, you respond to the call of a referee on the field, for example, and it's human error. It's like, these things are going to happen and they're in the public eye and there's so much pressure on them. It's almost like a matter of acceptance and forgiveness and hopefully for that particular athlete they're able to learn from.
But I think how many times can you say that this is okay and then, you know, other people having, I see where you're coming from, but then when do they grow up?
In an ideal world, they learn from that one particular moment.
So, but in terms of a media perspective, easy story, kid from Canberra with funny hair, precociously talented, likes his PlayStation or whatever you call iPad or whatever you call those things, throws his racket and bounces into the crowd. Idiot. That's the simple media story, okay? Oh, he's an idiot again. Oh, and now he's an idiot. Where's the piece, the layered piece, that gets to talk to Nick Kyrgios and say, well, how were you feeling in that moment? Or why did you do that? Or who are you and where are you from? And, you know, I don't like seeing it, but I want to know. I don't just want a simple story, you know. I actually want the full story. Mm. But maybe he won't give it.
And we're never going to have perfect athletes. You know, they don't. Yes, they train hard, and yes, they want to get to the best. And if they do end up getting there, it doesn't mean that in their DNA they're a perfect person. You know, naturally, sometimes you might get frustrated, and it could be more likely that that particular athlete is a repeat offender of that.
I think you want to see the emotions and the real person surface on the sporting field. I mean, that's kind of what we're looking for, above and beyond just sporting success, a demonstration of who people are. Yeah. It's just a fine line, isn't it?
Between doing something crazy and doing something that's just out of frustration. Yes, it is fine.
And it comes back to the values you want to propagate in the game and how you want to be perceived, which brings in the complexity of sponsors and the complexity of how you're perceived by young people. And if you want mums to let their children play rugby league and all of those sorts of things. And so, yeah, it's complex. And the point you make is true, is that they're not like... I know in rugby league, the elite sportsmen and women who play that, they're not like greyhounds who are groomed in a clinical kind of circumstance. You know, there's every chance that those young men have been pulled in from the margins, and some of them would have been exposed to domestic violence, alcohol, sexual abuse. And so this creates human complexity. Yeah. And so they can't be perfect all of the time. So there's got to be opportunities for them to learn.
I'm going to have to wrap up the conversation. I could sit here all night and talk about sport. I can tell you, I could keep going for another hour and a half, but I appreciate you've all got things to do. Thanks very much for coming along tonight. It's been a really terrific conversation. Thanks to the National Museum of Australia for hosting it, but especially thanks to our fantastic panel of guests, Sally, John, Louise, Christian and Chris.
It's a directorial prerogative that you get to have the last word. So I'm going to add in my own favourite sporting moment. It's actually when John Aloisi slotted in that goal.
Yeah.
Top three.
We all know that's the real defining moment in sport in this country in the last 50 years. I'll leave it at that. Thanks, everyone, for what was a great night of talking about sport, but actually talking about what it means to live in this country as well. And to see that the two things are intertwined as much as they are is part of the revelation of the night. Can I thank again our panellists, but our host, Paul Barclay, for his excellent work tonight. Thanks to the great team here at the National Museum. It's a shame that I can't name you all, but there's so many people that make an event like this come together. Thanks to the public programs team, to the curatorial team for defining moments who are here tonight as well, and to the media team. Thank you very much for all your great work. As flagged, this discussion will be broadcast on Monday, 22nd August, on RN's Big Ideas program at 8 p.m, so listen in. It always sounds different to when you listen in afterwards. That's what I find, actually. I'd like to invite you all to join us, join the panel, join those of us from the museum for a drink downstairs in the bay window. And I particularly thank our wine sponsors, Capital Wines. And while downstairs, you'll also have an opportunity to purchase the earlier mentioned edition of the Griffith Review, Our Sporting Life. If you enjoyed tonight's discussion and who didn't, please join us again here on September 21 for what will no doubt be a fascinating debate on the role of post-war immigration in defining our nation. As a son of Italian migrants, I feel personally implicated in that one. In the meantime, on the September 9, you'll also have a chance from that date to see a remarkable show that will open here at that time, called A History of the World in 100 Objects. Please come and see it. You won't see another show like it. And join us now for a drink downstairs. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.